Good morning. May it please the court, Ms. Geller. I'm Elizabeth Owen. I'm representing the plaintiff appellant, Anthony Garcia. At its core, this case is about the fundamental principles and the scope and power of the Colorado Department of Corrections, a question of monumental importance to our system of democratic government. Before the court may reach that important question, however, it must address the district court's erroneous dismissal of this case as being subject to the exclusivity provision of Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 106.5 and accordingly time barred. I hope today to address first the district court's error in dismissing this case, second, the applicable statute of limitations, and third, the unconstitutionality of the rules challenged in this case. With respect to the district court's dismissal of this matter, the district court held effectively that the only way that a prisoner can sue in state court is by using Colorado Rule of Civil Procedure 106.5. That holding is unduly broad and forecloses available avenues of relief to Mr. Garcia that are clearly established vehicles for challenging the constitutionality of rules and procedures and policies of the Colorado Department of Corrections. I'll turn first to Mr. Garcia's claim four. This is a claim that alleges that the Colorado legislature, which is named through Governor John Hickenlooper and the state of Colorado itself, has violated the Separation of Powers Clause by exempting the Colorado Department of Corrections from the provisions of the Colorado Administrative Procedures Act. This is a claim that challenges enactment of a statute. It is not brought against the Colorado Department of Corrections, and it does not deal with a quasi-judicial decision of the Colorado Department of Corrections. Rule 106 and Rule 106.5 address only judicial review of quasi-judicial decisions of either a state agency or the Colorado Department of Corrections. Neither the defendants to claim four nor the claim itself place the claim within the purview of Rule 106.5. The state didn't argue below that claim was subject to Rule 106.5 and therefore barred by its exclusivity provisions, and the court plainly erred when it dismissed that claim pursuant to a rule that says that it must have been brought pursuant to 106.5. With respect to claims 2 and 3, although these are claims brought against the Colorado Department of Corrections itself, they are similarly not claims challenging the quasi-judicial decision of the Colorado Department of Corrections, and accordingly, again, like with claim 4, are not subject to the time limitations set forth in that rule. With respect to claim 2, this is a claim...
May I interrupt, Ms. Owens? If we were to conclude that we disagreed with you on that last statement, that they are quasi-judicial decisions, isn't it pretty much automatically so that at least all the DOC people are out?
Yes, I think that's correct, Your Honor, actually. A point of clarification on this issue, actually, obviously, Mr. Garcia concedes on appeal that two of his claims are subject to the provisions of Rule 106.5. Those are claims 1 and 5. Frankly, the defendants, the individually named defendants, Harms, Falk, and, Harms and Falk, were relative to Mr. Garcia's claims 1 and 5. So I think that would be correct and also doesn't harm the remaining claims if those defendants were dismissed from this action.
Thank you.
Nonetheless, of course, Mr. Clements, who was originally named in this case, and now the executive director, of course, is Rick Ramish, is an official capacity defendant, and that has the effect of naming the Colorado Department of Corrections as an entity. So just to be clear on what the impact of dismissing those individually named defendants would have, we don't believe that it would impact the remaining claims. As I was addressing claim 2, this is a claim that alleges that the assault rule under the Colorado Department of Corrections Code of Penal Discipline is unconstitutionally vague. This is an attack on the rule itself. It's not an attack on the way that the rule was applied to Mr. Garcia in this case. Accordingly, it's outside the purview of Rule 106.
Now, but that rule no longer exists, so where does that leave your claim?
That's correct, Your Honor. Two things about that. One, With respect to the state's mootness argument, this is a really classic case of voluntary cessation. And, you know, the concern with voluntary cessation of an unconstitutional policy or practice is that it could resume immediately after the litigation is dismissed if a mootness argument were to be believed. And under these circumstances, the change of the rule not only does not provide that this claim should be dismissed, it supports our argument that the rule was unclear to begin with. I think the Department of Corrections has now recognized by its change in the rule, which specifically clarifies the issue that we have sought to address in this case, that the rule was vague before, and that it's possible for it not to be vague. So with respect to that claim two, the unconstitutionally vague claim, really, it's a simple matter at this point to declare the past rule unconstitutional and order that it not be reinstated once this action is no longer pending. With respect to claim three,
but how do we have a, you know, claim in controversy? I just don't understand that we declare past procedures or past rules. Given that there's a brand new rule that's not being challenged.
Sure.
What practical effect would such a ruling have?
Sure. I believe that Your Honor's question goes to the question of standing. So the fact that this rule was applied to Mr. Garcia in this case demonstrates the harm that he suffered from its existence. So the justiciable claim and controversy here comes from the fact not just that he was punished under this rule, but that he continues today to suffer the adverse consequences of being punished under an unconstitutional rule.
But I thought, and maybe you need to clarify, whether or not you're conceding that the as-applied challenge would be barred because it should have been brought under the administrative procedures and thus under Rule 106 and 106.5, whereas a facial challenge, you know, potentially could proceed outside of that framework. Are you still advancing an as-applied challenge?
Yes, Your Honor, we are advancing an as-applied challenge. And the distinction to be made between an as-applied challenge and a challenge that would, in a quasi-judicial, request for judicial review of a quasi-judicial action, it's still this distinction that we're challenging the rule itself. So I think the clearest way to think about this issue is to look at the relief available in the two types of actions that are at issue here. In a Rule 106 action, of course, there's very limited review and there's very limited relief. The relief available in a 106 action does not include declaration of a statute or rule as unconstitutional. What the relief granted in a case like that is expungement of the disciplinary conviction and reversal of the particular quasi-judicial decision. So I understand that there's this tricky line to walk between an as-applied challenge and actual review of a quasi-judicial action, but to be very clear, this is not a 106 action because we're seeking a declaration about the rule itself, which is not available in the Rule 106 context.
But excuse me, Ms. Owens, I am now confused.
Okay. Me too.
And as-applied challenge, I think, requires us to look at not only the rule, but how was it applied to this person? Mm-hmm. And that requires us to look at the facts of the application, i.e. the hearing. And I understand if you want to facially attack the rule and say that the rule is facially unconstitutional, that doesn't require us to do that. But if you're saying that it isn't an applied challenge, I don't see how we get around it. So I'm not understanding your distinction.
I certainly understand the court's concern. The critical question and the critical distinction there, again, just to reiterate, is the relief that we're seeking. So Rule 106 challenges and the exclusivity provision of Rule 106 is not to say that a court outside the 106 context can never consider the particular facts of a quasi-judicial action. We certainly don't dispute that a quasi-judicial action took place here, right? And the facts of that quasi-judicial action are also relevant to the challenges to the rule that was applied itself. But the difference is what we want at the end of the day. So I absolutely understand the court's concern getting into the territory of looking at the way that the facts were applied here. But the inquiry in claim two is whether a reasonable person would have understood that his or her conduct would be violative of this rule.
Isn't that a facial challenge, though?
So, yes, there's a facial challenge and an as-applied challenge. And it may be the case that the facial challenge is not subject to Rule 106, and the as-applied challenge is. I understand the distinction, but I would again just encourage the court to look at the relief that we're seeking, and understanding that the relief that we're seeking isn't available in the 106 context. So if the court were to hold that even the as-applied challenge is foreclosed by the exclusivity provisions of Rule 106, it would preclude Mr. Garcia from seeking any type of review whatsoever. And there's a critical issue here, too, with the fundamental fairness of requiring a prisoner, in order to challenge the constitutionality of a rule in 28 days. It's simply unfair to do that. And frankly, there's a continuing violation that is going on here that really every day, the fact that Mr. Garcia is subject to this disciplinary rule constitutes a new constitutional violation. So I understand the sticky point that the court is concerned about, but I think that it does not warrant a ruling that finds that Rule 106 is the exclusive vehicle for Claim 2. Claim 3 is the only claim that the state has alleged that the district court is actually subject to Rule 106. That is a claim that alleges that the Colorado Department of Corrections policy and practice of imposing monetary restitution through the disciplinary process is violative of the separation of powers doctrine. And this claim stems from the lack of express statutory authority that the Colorado Department of Corrections has been granted by the legislature to engage in conduct as alleged in the complaint. Again, this is an attack on the rule. It's not an attack on the way that the rule was applied in Mr. Garcia's case. And we submit that that renders it not subject to the provisions of Rule 106. I want to briefly address the statute of limitations argument that the state has made, arguing that this case is subject to a one-year statute of limitations. This is a case against the state of Colorado and the Colorado Department of Corrections. There's no dispute about that. And there's no dispute that that renders it subject to a two-year statute of limitations. And I would ask that the court reject that argument out of hand. If there are no further questions, I reserve the remainder of my time.
Of course. You have 2 minutes and 34 seconds. Good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. Nicole Geller, registration number 30147. Your Honor, as the court is aware, Mr. Garcia has appealed the dismissal of three out of the original five claims that were brought in this case. And the district court in the case below did order that all claims brought by Mr. Garcia be dismissed on the grounds that the court felt that Rule 106 was the exclusive remedy by which to bring those claims. And it is true that the defendants did not move to dismiss Mr. Garcia's claims number 2 and number 4 from the case on that particular basis, and did not assert that Rule 106 was his exclusive remedy. Nevertheless, the defendants would remind the court that if an appellate court will affirm a trial court decision and find that it was correct, even if the trial court used the wrong rationale. And the defendants do submit that there were appropriate and viable grounds for the dismissal of all claims asserted in the case, including those on appeal, in the motion to dismiss in the case below.
So as to those two claims that the court took on its own to dismiss pursuant to the rule, what other basis do we have to affirm the trial court's order?
Okay, with regard to the second claim for relief regarding the allegations that the definition of assault was unconstitutionally vague, there are several defenses, one of which is that that claim has been rendered moot to the extent it is a facial challenge and to the extent that they are seeking prospective injunctive relief. Another defense I believe that is meritorious is the statute of limitations, and then the third defense is a merits defense that the definition of assault, even previously, was not unconstitutionally vague. I would like to say a few things about mootness, just briefly, particularly because I believe that Mr. Garcia has alleged that the voluntary cessation doctrine is applicable to that claim, and so therefore it should not be deemed moot. While the claim has become moot because the Department of Corrections has redefined the definition of assault, I submit that that's not enough to invoke the voluntary cessation doctrine. When you look at the origins of that doctrine under Colorado case law, the key case is Van Schack Holdings Limited versus Bullenweider. And the rationale that the court articulated regarding the voluntary cessation doctrine was as follows. When a case becomes moot on appeal, the usual practice is to dismiss the appeal and vacate the lower court's judgment. The court went on to state, some courts, however, have recognized an exception to this procedure when the appealing party voluntarily takes an action which renders the appeal moot. This exception was created to prevent a party from mooting its appeal for strategic reasons so as to vacate the lower court's judgment. The defendants are not the appealing party. There is no basis to have that concern that the defendants made this change in order to moot the appeal and escape a judgment in the case below. They are the victors, at least at this point. So the doctrine under state law wouldn't have any application here. And to touch a little bit on federal law, which is not binding on the court, but can be informative on the issue of mootness, that doctrine, the voluntary cessation doctrine, is often applied, and it's not often applied, but it is applied sometimes in circumstances where there's a concern that a party has voluntarily ceased allegedly unconstitutional conduct for the purposes of avoiding a judgment, but only temporarily, and then will resume the conduct after the case is dismissed. There's absolutely nothing in this case to suggest that that is the reason that the definition of assault was changed.
I mean, part of the problem is that we have no idea because it was not in front of the trial court, and the trial court didn't make any findings about the new rule, whether it even exists, and for what reasons it was changed.
It's a dilemma because it became moot after the trial court proceedings and on appeal, but all parties do acknowledge that the definition was changed, and there's nothing more than this presumption that I respectfully submit is a little grandiose, that it was this case that caused the definition of assault to be changed. I would respectfully submit that if the court were to look at the administrative regulations of the Department of Corrections that are publicly available on its website and of which the court can take judicial notice, you see a marked change overall very recently in the way that the Department of Corrections is choosing to manage what it would refer to as close custody inmates. Those are inmates who are deemed to pose the most significant security risk. And the department overall has made a much better effort to capture people who engage in institutional violence and figure out how to manage them. And the changing of the definition of assault is consistent with that overall change to the regulations that you can see. So that at least is something the court can look at and take judicial notice of.
Well, unfortunately, we don't have much to look at in terms of why the trial court did what it did. I mean, we have less than a full page, pretty much lumping all of the claims together and dismissing them outright for untimeliness reasons. Why shouldn't we simply remand it so that the trial court gives us discussion claim by claim of its analysis? Why shouldn't we do that?
Because, Your Honor, ultimately the dismissal of all of the claims was correct, and the court can and should affirm the dismissal of those claims on appeal if it finds that there are bases in the record upon which dismissal is appropriate. And the defendants respectfully submit that there certainly are. Regrettably, the district court didn't address all of them, but they are there and the court can consider them. Speaking of that, I'd like to take a moment to talk in particular about the fourth claim for relief, which concerned the argument that the fact that the provisions of the State Administrative Procedures Act don't apply to the Department of Corrections, particularly with regard to inmate discipline, is a separation of powers violation. I believe that's the only claim from the defendant's perspective that is not encompassed by a threshold defense such as the statute of limitations or mootness or as a claim that could and should be brought under Rule 106. So before we totally run out of time, I would like to speak about it a little bit. As I would remind the court that the party challenging the statute has the burden of proving unconstitutionality under Cooper versus Hague. And again, I think probably it's fairly basic for all attorneys that the separation of powers doctrine imposes on each of the three different branches of government different duties and different authorities, and with that comes a prescription against interfering with those given to another branch of government. However, it's important to note in our state case law that the separation of powers doctrine does not require a complete division of authority among the three branches of government. And the court has stated the powers exercised by different branches of government necessarily overlap, and an absolute separation of government functions amongst co-equal branches is neither required nor desirable to achieve the Constitution's ultimate goal of effective and efficient government. So here we have a situation in which in CRS 17-1-111, the General Assembly exempted the Colorado Department of Corrections from the provisions of the APA for various categories, which included discipline. In the opening brief in this appeal, Mr. Garcia argues that under the modern view of the non-delegation doctrine, which has its source in the separation of powers doctrine, as discussed in the case Cottrell versus City and County of Denver, the General Assembly violated the separation of powers doctrine by exempting the Department of Corrections from the provisions of the APA and apparently specifically from the notice and hearing procedures that you find in the APA. I want to point out, though, that the Supreme Court, the Colorado Supreme Court, did not subject the agency in question in Cottrell either to the provisions of the APA or to notice in the hearing. The court stated in Cottrell that where an administrative or municipal agency is acting in a quasi-legislative rather than a quasi-judicial capacity, there is no constitutional requirement for notice and a hearing prior to rulemaking, which in that case concerned the setting of water rates. Here, it concerns the Code of Penal Discipline. But the principle is the same. There is no constitutional right to notice of a hearing, and the fact that that is provided under the APA for agencies to whom it applies doesn't mean that the legislature violated the separation of powers doctrine by exempting the DOC from those provisions, and Cottrell does not support that. I'd also like to note just briefly that to the extent that notice and a hearing is required for quasi-judicial activities, it's really undisputed that the Code of Penal Discipline provides notice, service of the notice, a hearing, sets forth whether you're entitled, what types of evidence can come in, how confidential information should be handled, provides for the receipt of a written disposition, an internal agency appeal, and a variety of other things that truly fully satisfy an individual's due process requirements. And so there just simply is no merit to claim four. And so even though the court in the case below did not address and dismiss that claim on that basis, it is appropriate to dismiss it based upon the assertions put forth in the motion to dismiss in this case, below.
Ms. Giller, may I ask a question about the statute of limitations?
Yes. Yes, you may, Your Honor, please.
I understand the government's position that all the CDOC people ought to be out. I get that. But I don't know that that same logic applies to the governor and to the state.
Your Honor, the defendants do not submit that it does apply to the governor and the state. But what they do submit is the governor and the state are not appropriate defendants for every claim for relief. We will stipulate and concede that the governor is appropriate and the state are appropriate parties for claim four, which is the claim I just discussed. But they're not for the two other claims that are on appeal concerning the definition of assault under the Code of Penal Discipline and the imposition of restitution as a sanction. And what is the authority for that? Well, under the case Developmental Pathways versus Ritter, the Colorado Supreme Court stated in that case, the evaluation of whether a person or entity is a proper party in a lawsuit must be determined in light of the relevant facts and circumstances. And so the governor can be an appropriate party when a party is challenging the constitutionality of a statute. But it's not, I would submit in this case, appropriate when what the party who's bringing the claim is really challenging are the specific actions of an administrative agency, where Colorado statute delegates the authority to make those decisions specifically to an administrative agency, and even more specifically to its executive director. And I think that is entirely consistent with the court's holding in Developmental Pathways versus Ritter. It did not stand for the principle that categorically, whenever you sue the state or a state agency about something that it's done, you can name the governor. And I think that's important to keep in mind because it makes a difference who is sued in a lawsuit. Obviously, for statute of limitations purposes, as you just raised, Your Honor, but it also affects where venue is proper, and it has an enormous impact on the case in terms of discovery, because the consequence of just naming the governor every time you're suing a state agency for actions really done by its executive director or others within it would mean that the governor would then potentially be required to appear for his deposition, even though he would have no knowledge of anything substantive in the case. He would be responsible for providing responses to written discovery, like interrogatories, requests for production, requests for admission. It really would have a meaningful impact in litigation that would be, I would submit, deleterious to the governor's ability to perform his normal functions. And so it really is appropriate to consider each individual claim if that is appropriately brought against the governor. And it's not. It's not with regard to Mr. Garcia's claims about the definition of assault under the COPD and about the decision to impose restitution as a sanction, because the authority to make those kinds of rules is given to the Colorado Department of Corrections and its executive director under 17.1-103. So to address the statute of limitations issues, that's the defendant's position. We're not trying to apply it to claims brought against the governor, but rather explain that the governor is not a proper party for anything other than claim four. I would also like to briefly, again, touch on the decision by the district court to dismiss claim three, which concerned the imposition of restitution as a sanction on the basis that that had to be brought pursuant to Rule 106. And I want to note that when you read the amended complaint and the briefs in the case below about that issue, it really does appear that that is not a facial challenge claim, but rather a claim attacking the imposition of restitution against Mr. Garcia in that particular hearing. That's what the statement of facts entirely concerns, and I believe even the language of claim three at its conclusion states that by imposing restitution against Mr. Garcia and garnishing his inmate account, the defendants violated his rights under the separation of powers clause. And so that claim, as it's alleged in the case below, really is that kind of challenge. And in the case Danielson versus Board of Commerce City, where a party made a similar kind of challenge in the case below, but then on appeal attempted to broaden their challenge to a facial legislative challenge, the Court of Appeals said, no, unfortunately, you can't do that. Your exclusive remedy was indeed Rule 106, and you needed to bring the claim that way. I see I'm out of time, but thank you very much.
Thank you, Counsel. Ms. Owens, you've got 2 minutes and 34 seconds.
Thank you. I'd like to first address the statute of limitations issue that the court was discussing with Ms. Geller. Ms. Geller concedes that the governor and the state of Colorado are both subject to a two-year statute of limitations. At the outset, we take the position that those are proper defendants for all of the claims in this case. The Colorado Supreme Court in Ainscough versus Owens held that when a party sues to enjoin or mandate enforcement of a statute, regulation, ordinance, or policy, it is not only customary but entirely appropriate for the plaintiff to name the body ultimately responsible for enforcing that law. Moreover, when that body is an administrative agency or the executive branch of government or even the state itself, the governor, in his official capacity, is a proper defendant because he is the state's chief executive. This is that case. This is an administrative agency. This is a policy of that administrative agency. Notwithstanding, the executive director of the Colorado Department of Corrections is also a proper defendant in his official capacity in this case and also not subject to a one-year statute of limitations. With respect to Mr. Garcia's claim 4, that the statutory exemption from the APA violates the separation of powers clause, the state is correct that plaintiff bears the burden of proving the unconstitutionality of this statute, and what we're asking to do is be provided the opportunity to prove that. This is a state court case. Notice pleading is the standard on a motion to dismiss, and the state simply hasn't put forth any legitimate reasons that plaintiff has failed to state a claim. They admit that there is no procedural bar, such as Rule 106, or a statute of limitations to that case. This is a case where the Colorado Department of Corrections usurped both legislative and judicial power when it wrote a statute that it wasn't allowed to write, when it awarded itself civil damages without a court order, and garnished Mr. Garcia's inmate account without a court order. That violates the separation of powers clause. Turning to the mootness issue, the critical question in the voluntary cessation doctrine is whether there were made relief available to the party alleging unconstitutional conduct that has not yet been afforded. That is the case here. Mr. Garcia has not been returned to the position he would have been in but for the application of this unconstitutional policy, and he hasn't gotten his costs in this case, and for that reason the voluntary cessation doctrine applies. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you both, counsel, for your arguments. We appreciate them very much. The case will stand submitted, and an opinion will issue in due course. And for counsel today, safe journey home.